Hello and welcome to Conscious Living. I'm Wendy Garrett. This is Empower Radio. Thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you're having a great time. Wherever you are, whatever time of day it is, I appreciate you listening. Guest today is also connected to the Monroe Institute. We had an earlier interview this spring talking about how we would do some shows with them to kind of give you more idea of what they do into consciousness research and that kind of thing. A lot of people know them because of their work with out-of-body experiences and that kind of stuff. Bob Monroe did a whole lot of incredible work kind of paving the way for that kind of information and learning how to expand our own sense of awareness into our reality. Use the term loosely. There are many states of reality. Anyway, we're going to find out more about Eben Alexander, who is a doctor, a neurosurgeon. And when he had his life-changing experience, it's just one of those things that happens. He decided to go a whole different direction. I'm going to let him explain that. Dr. Alexander, I really appreciate your time. I've done a little bit of research. I've got your website pulled up. So if people are listening, they can follow along. Lifebeyonddeath.net. is your home site, and the book, it's 2012, the year the story is told. What is that the title?
Wendy, it's great to be here. The title is something that's still in flux. It's a book that'll be published by Simon & Schuster, probably published sometime between December of 2012 and February 2013. And right now, I think the title is going to be Journey into the Afterlife, a Neurosurgeon's Near-Death Experience, something to that effect. But I'll keep postings there, lifebeyonddeath.net, all about presentations, all about the book and its publication, and other information.
Okay, now this is an extraordinary story. Dr. Moody, who's done all sorts of research on this, says you are an enigma.
Well, I would say I'm a very fortunate soul, to say the least. But it really is. I mean, the entire story. I still have to kind of pinch myself to, realize that all this is so incredibly powerful, and it's kind of an astonishing story that has everything to do with my life spent in academic neurosurgery. Where I had worked more than 20 years in academic neurosurgery, including 15 years at Harvard Medical School as an active neurosurgeon, and thought I had a very good idea of how the brain and mind and consciousness and soul and spirit and all that, how it all works. And basically, it was a very modern scientific view that said that the brain is responsible for all of consciousness and all of awareness and for the existence of what we would call spirit and soul. And of course, after all that time spent in neurosurgery, my conclusion was that when the brain goes, I couldn't see any way that consciousness and soul and spirit remained. And because of my near-death experience, which very profound, happened in November 2008, was totally out of the blue, I've come to realize that everything that I thought before about the brain and consciousness was completely wrong. And it's been a great awakening for me.
Now, that had to really be, beyond the personal thing of you devote all of your life to that and then find that it's exactly the opposite of what you had believed. That's a whole paradigm shift.
It is. I mean, people often say that near-death experiences are life-changing, and I can tell you from my viewpoint, they absolutely are completely life-changing. And I think the interesting thing is if any of my patients had gone through what I experienced and then come back from coma after a week in coma and told me this story, I would have said, well, of course you were very sick. And when people are very sick, anything can happen in a brain that's almost dead. And it turns out that there were some very crucial clues within my experience that show that you cannot dismiss it so readily at all. And in fact, it supports very strongly literally tens of thousands of other reported NDEs about the reality of that situation deep in the spiritual realm. And contrarily, I would say that they also support my NDE very strongly, because just to briefly go into it, I suddenly became ill on the morning of November 10th, 2008, just totally out of the blue, was stricken by a very rare bacterial meningitis. And within a few hours, it drove me into coma. And I don't remember anything of the next week, not the tiniest bit of anything that happened around me. But I remember everything that happened deep within coma. And turns out on the second day, my physicians found out that I had spontaneous E. coli meningitis, which is very rare in adults. It's about a 1 in 10 million annual incidence. And so that was surprising enough. But then even worse was the fact that I did not respond to very strong triple antibiotics. They were not sure why that was happening, but it was a very difficult time for my family, as you can imagine, because by the end of the week, things were not looking at all good. Even at the beginning of the week, by having bacterial meningitis and a very rapid descent into coma, that basically, when I hit the emergency room, my chances of dying from that illness were already above 90%. And then as the week went on, that chance of dying from it went up and was getting close to, you know, 98, 99%. I mean, it's hard to put numbers on it because it was so rare. And at that point, recovering from this illness, you know, to the point of actually having normal neurologic function, basically had no realistic probability at all. I mean, the chances were that if I did live through it by the end of the week, that I would probably be in the hospital 2 or 3 months and then spend the rest of my life in a nursing home. So it's a very extraordinary thing. And then all of a sudden, to everybody's surprise, after 7 days in coma on a ventilator, I started to wake up. And meningitis had been so severe, it had completely erased all of my memories of life. All of my language, any knowledge of humans, this universe was gone, and yet I had this extremely rich, vivid experience deep in coma that was very more real than this, more real than this earthly reality. And it was just so shocking to come back with that. And it was a very deep spiritual journey. And if you would ask me before my coma, what would somebody remember, you know, after a week of severe bacterial meningitis, a week of coma, I would say they won't remember anything, nothing at all. And that's why it was so surprising, because I remember this very rich odyssey that I went through in that spiritual realm. And in fact, my oldest son was majoring in neuroscience at the time, Evan the Fourth, and he had seen me when I was in coma, and then when I got out of the hospital, he had driven home from school. He was very surprised, of course, and he could see I was still kind of fragile around the edges. I still had a PICC line in for antibiotics when I was home and all that. And I told him I really wanted to write this up. It was so astonishing. And I couldn't explain how that hyper-real sensation could occur. And my intention was to write it up as a neuroscientific report, you know, what it's like in coma. And I thought that, you know, by reading a lot and studying a lot and learning a whole lot more about my medical situation, I could somehow explain why that extreme hyper-reality sense was there and explain some of the elements of this very bizarre and vivid story, this odyssey that I went through. Over time, what I came to realize is that, in fact, all of my hypotheses from a neuroscientific standpoint, and there were actually 9 pretty detailed hypotheses about how this might happen in the brain, every one of them failed. I mean, there was no, after months and months of research and talking this over with other neurosurgeons, neuroscientists, my problem was that there was no way to explain what I experienced as having happened in my brain. And the conclusions from that, especially with a very rigorous analysis trying to prove it from a neuroscientific standpoint, the conclusions are really quite world-changing. I mean, they absolutely changed my life, and I think the more people who hear about this story, and certainly a lot of the scientists and neuroscientists, it really is kind of stunning what it tells us about the nature of reality. And it all hinges on the phenomenon of consciousness. And that's really why I got so interested in the Monroe Institute, which I found out about after right around 2 years after I came out of coma. And I had given a talk up at UVA on my experience, and Carol Sabic Delaherrin, who is now the head of the Monroe Institute, and Karen Malik, who had worked with Bob Monroe all the way back into the 1970s, came up to hear my talk, and afterwards they had invited me to come visit at the Monroe. And so I was there a little bit later, which would have been in, you know, maybe the third week of November of 2010. I had just read about Monroe Institute in a book from 1991 called The Holographic Universe, and then also somebody had contacted me within a few days and asked me if I knew of the Monroe Institute. And I figured when I get 3 strikes like that in one, you know, brief period of time, you know, about something like Monroe Institute, that I better go check it out. And that's exactly what I did, and was just fascinated at what Bob Monroe had uncovered, and then also fascinated by how it might help me to get back into my deep coma experience, my near-death experience.
My question is, when you came back and you started to recover, because obviously you had to relearn language, relearn everything, did that eventually give you your full recovery, being able to do the neurosurgeon aspect of it as well, or what happened with that?
Yeah, well, the recovery, and again, I think it's important to emphasize that I don't think any of my physicians, or certainly any physicians who know anything about meningitis, would have expected a very rapid and complete recovery. I mean, in fact, a complete recovery was just about out of the picture. And so it really has been quite shocking how rapidly things came back. And probably the best thing to say about that is just to point out that there are other cases of very kind of deep transcendental near-death experiences where people who do return benefit from kind of astounding and medically seemingly impossible levels of restoration of their health. I mean, there are numerous examples of that, and I wish I could explain exactly how that happens, because as a physician, if you are witness to some kind of wonderful episode of healing, you'd like to kind of analyze it and be able to report exactly how it happened so that you can give it to your colleagues and they can write a prescription for the same thing. And that's part of what I'm doing now, is trying to get more into the very nature of those kind of healing episodes, to see if there are things that we can learn in medicine that would help bring that kind of extraordinary healing that occurs in some near-death experiences, and bring it, make it more available to people in all kinds of settings. And of course, part of that is probably trying to understand better why some people have come back with a near-death experience memory, but that only seems to be maybe 15 or 20% of people who medically, you know, go deep inside, say with a cardiac arrest or whatever, and then come back. Only 15 to 20% of them actually come back with memories that we call a near-death experience. And I don't have an explanation why the others don't. But to get back to your question, my language, as I pointed out, my language was completely gone deep inside the experience. And when I initially was coming back in those first minutes when I was waking up, but language started coming back very rapidly. So I would say my language was taken offline really for my benefit in the near-death experience. And that has to do with the fact that my meningitis was so severe. And the thing that people need to understand about meningitis is it's probably the ideal mechanism for mimicking human death. Because it basically takes a severe case of meningitis, takes the whole outer surface of the brain, what's called the neocortex, which is the part that makes us human. There's nothing deep inside that really makes us human. All the stuff that's deep inside is more primitive and has evolved in other life forms. There are other mammals and especially primates that have a neocortex, which is that outer surface, and humans have the most highly developed neocortex. So, like I said, that's exactly what makes us human. And that's why meningitis is such an interesting disease, because if you have a very severe case of meningitis, it really attacks first and foremost and most effectively that outer surface that makes us human. It turns out that most people who have severe meningitis die of it. And those who have a severe case and survive it somehow come back wrecked. They don't come back with human capabilities intact. And but they do have a chance of surviving it because some of those deeper structures in the brain that could keep a body alive don't bear the brunt of the disease. So in the people who actually can live through it, you know, and come back, usually they don't come back with much of their human faculties intact. And that's one reason that I'm so blessed to have come back with all of this still working. But I bring it up because it's important when you look at near-death experiences, you know, what's the kind of medical condition that drives somebody in there? And I never would have thought of it before, but it certainly started to make sense to me in the months after I was recovering, that it was very useful to have had meningitis in a very severe case. In fact, just to kind of put it in perspective, one measure of the severity is the CSF glucose level, the glucose or sugar level in the fluid around the brain and spinal cord. In most people, it's 60 to 80. And in cases of severe bacterial meningitis, it might drop as low as 20. And in my case, it went down to 1. And no one who was taking care of me and none of the consultants at other institutions had heard of somebody with a severe bacterial meningitis whose glucose level went down to 1. But that plus my neurologic exams, my CT scans, everything about it showed that it was a very severe meningitis. And that has been helpful in my analysis because if I'd had some other disease that puts you into coma, like a head trauma, a subarachnoid hemorrhage, say a brain abscess or brain tumor with swelling, any number of those things can put you into coma, but they generally are fairly imperfect at wiping out the human part of the brain, whereas meningitis, from the very get-go, is attacking mainly the outer neocortex, which is the part that makes it human, and that's why, you know, after a week of severe meningitis, you just really wouldn't expect any part of that cortex to still be functioning. And the cortex is the only place where you can actually put together rich, interactive, audiovisual, and kind of higher function conceptual modeling of the world, which is exactly what I witnessed. In fact, what I recall from deep in coma was such a rich, kind of vibrant fabric of reality, very interactive, with incredible conceptual flow. And I don't think that my brain right now could muster that at all, even though I think my neocortex is fully intact. So it really, it's one of those interesting facets. I mean, one quote that I absolutely love about this that I often say in my talks is that we are conscious in spite of our brain. And it's one of those things that goes totally against everything that I learned as a neuroscientist and coming along as an active neurosurgeon. And yet I've come to realize that consciousness is a far more profound entity than I ever recognized before, and that assumption that I had taken as proven for so many decades, you know, that the brain generates consciousness, is wrong. And we had evidence very strongly suggesting you know, the false nature of that assumption, really going back to the advent of quantum mechanics almost 100 years ago, because I think a lot of the scientists involved in quantum mechanics, like Heisenberg and Planck, Max Planck, and Erwin Schrodinger, and Niels Bohr, Albert Einstein, many of them turned to mysticism. They were so astonished by what their experiments told them about reality, because essentially the experiment said that consciousness is a crucial part of manifesting reality. There's not some big reality out there unfolding, and we're simply observing it. We are very active participants, no matter how we like to stage it, and that is something that I don't think the physics community has ever been able to explain in any kind of a satisfactory fashion. I mean, they're still very much kind of lost in, you know, how to interpret these experiments from quantum mechanics and what they say about consciousness. And there are a few physicists who have taken this head-on, people like Roger Penrose and Claude Swanson, who I think are very good at kind of addressing what we need to know about reality and about modern physics to try and come up with a model of consciousness that really tells us about our existence.
I want to interject something here. You mentioned Claude Swanson, and there are two books that are really very, very helpful if you're studying this stuff and trying to get a grasp on, well, okay, what does the science factor in? Is there science for it? There's Reams, and he has done a fabulous job of getting some of this together. Synchronized Universe is one of the books. The other one's Life Force, The Scientific Right. Basis. These things I looked into when I had my own experiences of what I term the altered state, you know, other parallel realities and ways of being and things that happen in my own life that are unexplainable. And you have to go, it's like there's no one-stop shopping for these answers, because the way we have our world set up in the Western world is this doesn't exist. It's you're ludicrous. You're written off as just Looney Tunes when you start telling people that your time has shifted, that you see things that aren't here, that you hear valid and very precise information that's accurate from something nobody else can see. And once you start doing those things, then you have to go outside the box to look for answers. And at least Claude Swanson has done a great job in getting some of the science behind some of these altered state experiences that people have been having. With you, you know, you are so articulate. You are so precise when this is the date, this is the time, this is all that. That is still a part of you. And do you think that was one of the reasons why, or suspect that this might have had a connection with why you would experience something like this and be able to come back and articulate in a very precise manner everything that you experienced, so it would provide some kind of a documentation, some kind of a scientific basis for us to get from point A to point B where we haven't managed to do that before?
Well, I think that's a wonderful question, and you can bet I've wrestled with that a lot over the last 3.5 years since I came back. I think for me, so much of this is about the message, you know, and of in my own life, I can look back and even see things that I think happened well before I was born that kind of had to happen the way they did for all this to really unfold, and I think that'll all become clear in my book about exactly what I'm talking about, and I really don't have a lot of time to go into that now, but I think it's important to stress that the environment for this kind of understanding has been evolving in the neuroscience of consciousness and the philosophy of mind for the last at least 20 to 30 years. I mean, we're really talking about the whole mind-body problem that goes back, at least to the 5th century B.C.
Okay, let's take a quick break. I hate to interrupt you, but we'll continue with that. We'll pick up with that after the break. And again, we want to get into how the HemiSync from the Monroe Institute fits into this as well, because you don't have to die to be able to do this. And that's right. What Dr. Alexander is going to help us with when we come back to Conscious Living on Empower Radio. I'm Wendy Garrett.
I'm home and I love it. I'm home where I belong. I'm home and I love it. I'm home where I belong.
It's always nice to come home, but these days, many Americans are at risk of foreclosure and losing their homes. Fortunately, help is available. Making Home Affordable is a free program from the U.S. government that has already helped over 1 million struggling homeowners, and we want to help you.
I'm home.
I'm home.
And I love it. I'm home.
I'm home.
Find out now what your options are. Go to makinghomeaffordable.gov or call 1-888-995-HOPE. The sooner you act, the better chance we can help you.
I'm home.
I'm home.
Where I be.
Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Excuse me, do you know how to get to Maine and Maple?
Do you have these in a 7.5?
How's that cooked?
Can I get that shipped overnight?
Is there a direct flight?
How long does the warranty last?
What's your soup of the day?
How do you change the ringtone?
Does it come in blue?
Does this bus stop at Elm Street?
We ask questions everywhere in life.
Is it raining out?
What time's the meeting?
How much does this cost?
Does it have four-wheel drive?
Have we met before?
What's my account balance?
Yet somehow, when we get to the doctor's office...
Any questions?
No.
We clam up. Ask questions.
What is this test for?
Are there any side effects?
When do I get my results?
Questions lead to better health care. Go to ahrq.gov for a list of 10 questions everyone should know. Questions are the answer. Public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
My name is Meera Batra. I have been in this country 32 years, and this is how I live united. America has always been the land of promise, and in my community, many families have come for a better life. Coming from another culture myself, I know the desire to become part of a community, to feel at home, and to gain the tools for our children and families to succeed. So I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to look beyond their histories and to see what opportunities are available. We help them get involved with their kids' schools, network within the community, and when we do, we unite them. We make the community stronger. What I do is something I wish someone had done for me, and I am so grateful I am able to. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunities and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give. Advocate. Volunteer. Live United. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Hi there. I'm Wendy Garrett. This is Conscious Living on Empower Radio, talking with Dr. Evan Alexander about his story and what he experienced as a result of a near-death experience, how it changed his life. He was talking as we went into the break about how this consciousness research has been going on for a long time, and we're just now... It isn't that the question hasn't been out there and the people haven't supposed and theorized and all that. It's just that we don't have that hard data that says this is real. Is that a good way of paraphrasing it?
Yeah, I think so. And as we went into the break there, I was talking about the whole mind-body problem, and this is something that's been discussed, as I said, since at least the 5th century BC, and of course in the 17th century, Rene Descartes taking kind of the position that you had kind of mind, the mind side and the material side, and in a sense that was a truce with the church, so that natural, those with an interest in natural science could pursue that without necessarily getting burned at the stake. But anyway, it all kind of evolved into our 20th century discussion, and of course the the track record for materialist science in the 20th century was tremendous. So what we conventional science, and yet there was always that question in the back of their minds about quantum mechanics and what it was telling us about reality, and that consciousness seemed to play a very crucial role in the unfolding of reality. And it turns out that in the latter part of the 20th century, I would say that there was a lot of awareness growing in the world of neuroscience, in consciousness studies, in philosophy of mind, that in fact, trying to take what's called the reductive materialist view, which is that if you understand everything there is to say about electrons, quarks, protons, neutrons, atoms, physics, chemistry, take that up through biology and then neuroanatomy and neurophysiology of the human brain, that you would then be able to explain how consciousness emerges from all that. And the problem is that I think some of the foremost thinkers in the field basically started hitting an absolute wall. There was no way to take it to the next step. And to this day, there's no one who has the remotest idea what the first sentence of that chapter is about how the material world and specifically the human brain and the neuroanatomy and physiology based on all the biology, chemistry, and physics, how that then leads to consciousness. And that is kind of a profound realization. It was crystallized as kind of a term called The Hard Problem of Consciousness by David Chalmers in his wonderful book in 1996 called The Conscious Mind. But like I said, the thinking and kind of many points of view and lines of evidence and reasoning that led to that kind of conclusion that the hard problem, how does consciousness come out of physical reality, basically I think is going to end up being the only thing we know of in all of human knowledge that we might be able to prove is an insoluble question, one that is insoluble by the human brain and mind. That's not to say that it's not soluble in some very special fashion, which I really won't go into right now, but it is a very, very deep question, how consciousness emerges. And I became more and more aware of that as I was studying my own NDE. And then, on top of that, after I gave that talk at the Division of Perceptual Studies at UVA and met all the wonderful people up there, Bruce Grayson, Ed Kelly, Jim Tucker, Ross Dunseith, there's a whole host of very wonderful people there who've done incredible work. And one of the things they did was put together a book called Irreducible Mind, Toward a Psychology for the 21st Century, which I would highly recommend to any scientists or those with a kind of a heavy scientific leaning. Although it is a very dense book, it's about 800 pages of evidence that really talks about all manner of things that are what I refer to as extended consciousness, things like remote viewing, precognition, psychokinesis, different forms of intuition and telepathy. And these are real phenomena. And I think the scientific world has been slow to accept their reality. And that's why Irreducible Mind is such an important book. It really points out that these are real phenomena. And in fact, there's I have an article that I just wrote that's there's a link on the welcome page of my website that I wrote for the neurosurgical population, and I talked there about irreducible mind and what an important work it is. I also talked about two conferences that the American Institute of Physics hosted in 2006 and 2011 on what's called retrocausality, or the frontiers of time, which really addresses these issues of how do we have a way of knowing things and influencing the future, influencing microelectronics, and also causing the past to change. I mean, these are all things that sound very strange, and yet the American Institute of Physics and people who are interested in very advanced studies of quantum mechanics and of consciousness realize that these are phenomena that are real. And they're very difficult to prove and understand, and I think part of that is because we're knocking right on the door of, you know, the very nature of existence, and that's where things get very kind of strange and difficult to interpret and understand. That doesn't mean that they aren't real, and that, I think, has been the huge realization that my NDE presented me with, is to know that consciousness is a far more profound mystery, and the very fact that the American Institute of Physics is hosting these kind of meetings, which were hosted in San Diego by Daniel Sheehan, really kind of speaks to the fact that for people who are interested in truth and reality, you know, in the year 2012, we really have to be very open-minded, and to think that we're close to a theory of everything, to think we're close to understanding it all, to think we're close to designing, you know, a computer that's conscious, is the highest form of hubris. Because, in fact, in my NDE, I saw just how grand this universe really is, and it's far grander than I ever would have surmised before.
Okay, my question is, when somebody has a scientific background, I mean, it's beautiful. I really respect and admire people who have all the numbers and have that incredible intellect to be able to do that. But in my experience, it's so far removed from the one who's able to do this kind of work, such as, you know, shift an entire way of viewing something to a completely opposite spectrum, to be able to have these experiences with those who are unseen but are still very concrete in my world, and, you know, have somebody right beside me who is a physics brilliant but cannot have that experience because his mind simply doesn't work that way. And that's not a negative. That's saying we are so hardwired for each of us to have our unique experiences that it's taken us this long to say, okay, maybe we need to collaborate, cooperate, and get into each other's own way of seeing the world with different perspectives, instead of trying to think that only one person is going to be able to come up with this answer. Because no matter how brilliant that mathematical equation, no matter how incredibly on target, it's still math. And these things are experiences, and some of them do not have words. Does that make sense?
It makes wonderful sense. And in fact, I think one thing I'd really like to point out is that a big part of my message, especially since I came into the Monroe Institute and learned about what Bob Monroe was doing and about these extended phenomena of consciousness and how real they are, is that a lot of the understanding of this is within our own consciousness. In fact, for a while after my NDE, I thought that a real enemy to understanding some of these things is that linguistic brain, is the ego, is the, you know, kind of sense of self within. And that's, you know, kind of the voice of the rational scientific worldview. And yet it gets in the way of some of the deeper knowing that is available to us. Deep in my NDE, I was learning things as complete conceptual flow that was instantaneous and complete. And those kinds of information are available to us through deep meditation. And in fact, what I would say is that you can go to all the, you know, conferences, and you can take courses, and you can watch the DVDs and all this to try and learn about, you know, the mysteries of consciousness here. But at the end of the day, each and every one of us has to go into our own consciousness to really get the deepest answers. And that's one of the things that I've really loved about working my work with the Monroe Institute and everything that they do, because in fact, you know, they're very non-dogmatic. The only dogma at the Monroe Institute is I am more than my physical body. And it stops there. There's no other dogma you need to buy into. And that's one of the problems, I think, with modern religion and a lot of conventional modern science, is that you're asked to accept a lot of dogmatic thinking from others. And that's where we really hit the hurdles. If you want to get to truth and you want to get to having a deeper understanding of reality, that does not involve buying into somebody else's thinking, somebody else's dogma. And that's why I've really enjoyed a lot of the work that I've done with the Monroe Institute, because I've found that so much of what they are talking about is giving you tools to do deep conscious exploration so that you can actually encounter your own guidance and get a lot of your own answers. And by being in a community where you have a lot of people who have the same kind of interest and the same kind of way of communicating and the same kind of way of getting at kind of a deeper understanding of reality, it just fosters the growth in each and every person who participates so that they can learn a lot more of these kind of truths.
Well, it's nice, too, because when you're talking about something, you have the benefit of knowing that other people have had these extraordinary life-altering, for the most part, experiences. And so you're coming from a similar frame of reference. You know, you have some kind of context there that you're seeing similar views, and or at least you can appreciate that if you don't have the same view, that you have the capacity to know that that person has already been to a level that most people aren't fluent in. And may have given thought to things being beyond our ability to conceptualize at this point. I like the way when you said there's no dogma, the only dogma is, you know, I am more than this body. Instead of looking at it from all the other angles where you have to really hold on to a certain way of thinking, grasp a certain state of being to go to the next level, what the Monroe Institute is saying, let go of everything. Let go. You are more. And so it's just the exact opposite from that very premise where you start to go and grow and learn and expand your current state of awareness into a new state of being. And that, you know, what I read is it takes about 10 years to be able to articulate and integrate an experience like this. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. So in a sense, I'm still kind of a newbie. You know, I'm only 3.5 years out from this, and I'm very cognizant of the fact that I'm still, you know, it's all still kind of maturing inside of me and my understanding of it. You had brought something up earlier, though, kind of along these lines that I'd like to get back to, and that's the whole idea that you don't have to almost die to get to that kind of deep, profound experience that, like I had and like literally millions of other people have had in near-death experiences. And that gets back to this whole idea of the deep meditative states and, you know, using transcendental meditation, different kinds of yoga. I mean, there are multiple ways to get into these deep mystical states and experiences. And for me, the one that presented itself and that has been so useful and that I personally recommend, but I'm, you know, I haven't done others to the depth so that I could actually compare any, but that is the hemisync, especially that Monroe has, he developed, Bob Monroe developed that whole hemisync approach, and they make it available. And, of course, the best thing to do is actually to take the courses with the trained facilitators. In other words, I wouldn't tell somebody to, you know, get a few hemisync CDs and listen to them and then make a decision, yes or no, whether they think they have learned new things. I can tell you as a neuroscientist, I find the hemisync to be absolutely fascinating, what it does. And it actually is interacting with a circuit deep in the brainstem that evolved when vertebrates evolved, 400 million years ago, and it's doing something with that circuit that then seems to free up conscious awareness and make and take it to the non-local and non-temporal realm, which you know, I mentioned a few minutes ago, the American Institute of Physics, those two seminars in 2006 and 2011, they had everything to do with non-local consciousness, and also consciousness unstuck in you know, temporal, in time reality. And there's a wonderful book by Dr. Pim Van Lommel, Consciousness Beyond Life, which I can highly recommend to people who are interested. I know him, have presented with him at several meetings, and he does a wonderful job of putting a lot of this in perspective. And by the way, a lot of these books I mentioned, in fact, all the ones I mentioned are on my reading list on my website at lifebeyonddeath.net. Just go to that reading list, and they're right there. But Pim Van Lommel put together an incredible book that talked about the non-local, non-temporal nature of consciousness that has to do with the whole notion that, you know, the quantum mechanics is not only telling us something fundamental about reality, but probably even more importantly, it's telling us something very crucial about consciousness. And practical dealing with all that, that is getting your consciousness to a point where it is freed up from space and time, is something that you encounter with the hemisync and with that kind of deep meditation. And that's why it can be so extremely useful at getting into some of these deep mystical states and finding out a whole lot more about what, you know, a near-death experience, the territory that that takes one to, but without having to almost die. And that's why I recommend it so highly.
And if you're wanting to find out more, the Monroe Institute is available, monroeinstitute.org, and you can find out about the hemisync program. And it's just basically working with audio and sound patterns to help you redirect that energy. For me, having this non-physical connection with guides, I was given a wonderful vision. And as I saw the vision, because they were saying, you can see more. We humans can see more if we develop our ability. So what I was guided to do was focus. And I saw the lamp in front of me change, and it began to wave instead of being stationary. It was waving. And as it waved and I looked at that, that drew my mind, occupied it. Out of the peripheral view, I could see the individual standing in that area beside me. And actually, they were more like floating. But I could see them because my mind was engaged at this other thing and kind of focusing on what that was doing. And it, in a way, these kinds of things are showing us that just because we don't see something with our eyes does not mean it isn't present. And there are lots of ways of doing it. For me, it's more of a mystical and mysticism kind of thing. I can't duplicate it, but with the Monroe equipment, you can do something that you can hopefully get a repeat experience. In other words, induce either a trance state or a meditative state where you can just become more relaxed, go to sleep, have higher functioning, all sorts of stuff through the assistance. And you're also a teacher, is that correct, with the Monroe Institute?
Yes, I'm a facilitator. I work with them, and I'm also heading up their research program right now, which is very interesting. And I think there's a tremendous amount of work to be done in this world, because to say that it has to do with sound patterns and what they do to the brain is, you know, that's how it was first put to me by Carol and Karen when they came and heard my talk at UVA. And I cannot tell you how much, the true nature of what it is doing to consciousness is so spectacular and astonishing. It goes far, far beyond simply being some little sound patterns and what they do to relax you. I can tell you a phenomenal effect, and it has everything to do with what I said earlier, that we are conscious in spite of our brain, and has everything to do with getting into consciousness that is completely freed from that kind of the physical limitations of the human brain which by extension are limitations of our conscious mind in this reality. But it turns out that we have a higher consciousness that is not at all locked into this realm of those same physics.
Anything. To me, Taoism is one of the best things. It's a flow. There is something when you try to name it, you've lost it. Once you try to conceptualize it, which the brain always does, that's the function of the brain, to compartmentalize, to try and decipher, to try and label. As soon as you do that, you lose it. And once you get out of that mode of constantly trying to articulate what it is, because that keeps you from doing anything, that puts you right there in the box. That's why I said this mathematic thing, that's tough, because as soon as you've got this beautiful, beautiful equation, all of these beautiful pieces of writing, and that's what they are by definition. The experience is something that is beyond that. And when you try to write it, you lose it. And at least that's my awareness or my perception of it. I love the math, but so far it isn't blending like the particle and the wave to show the big picture.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that's a very good point. I mean, so much of this, there's a very true understanding and comprehension that can come in that realm of consciousness that's completely freed up from the physical limitations of the brain and mind. And it's, I think the challenge is some of the information that we are privy to in those deep conscious states that are so freed up from our normal states of consciousness, it's difficult to bring a lot of that back. Some of it can be brought up back, but I mean that's something I faced with my near-death experience. There are things that you encounter there. I mean, just the whole means of acquisition of knowledge, even things like what I remembered as kind of video and auditory, they were so intermixed and so astonishingly rich and beyond what we see as, you know, kind of seeing and hearing and, you know, the way we picture ourselves in this world, that you can't even translate them into human language because they're so different and so kind of exotic and enhanced. We really don't have language for that kind of thing yet, but of course that's something that I'd like to work on. With more experience with all this
I have a question of your experiences in that near death. What is the most profound that you can share, that you can articulate, aside from saying it's really rich?
I'll go into great detail in my book. It's so hard to know where to start. I can tell you that the spiritual experience, for one thing, I started with this prolonged period of what I call the earthworm eye view, which was very kind of monotonous and dull and underground. I felt like I was there for years, but I was rescued from that by this beautiful, spinning, very filamentous, fine, brilliant light that was spinning slowly in front of me. And as it spun and enlarged, it opened as a portal that took me into this beautiful world that was ultra real, beyond perfect, colors beyond description. A verdant valley where I was a speck on a butterfly wing and with a beautiful girl beside me, and these arcs of light above and these hymns coming down from the arcs of light swooping in the sky. I mean, the beauty of it and the rich, incredibly vivid fabric of that reality unfolding, and with this beautiful girl who never spoke, but her thoughts came straight into my mind. And then going from that ultra-real, incredibly crisp realm outside of this entire universe with a brilliant orb of light and this incredible sense of unconditional love. And the power of unconditional love is infinite. And basically can drive, and does drive, everything good in this world. And it's by tapping into that, and so many people have had NDEs come back with these same kind of concepts, and it's so hard to put it into words, but the unconditional love is at the very core of it all. And that's something that people can definitely get in touch with in these deep conscious states, is to be that love coming directly from the creative source.
We got to stop now, Dr. Eben Alexander. We'll talk more. I would love to talk with you again if you're available, because it's a little time between the book coming out. LifeBeyondDeath.net is the website for Dr. Alexander. Thank you so much. And you can also check out the Monroe Institute and maybe take a class from Dr. Alexander while you're at it. Thank you for listening, and thank you for giving us your time this afternoon. This is Conscious Living Empower Radio. I'm Wendy Garrett.
This is Joe Perry
and Steven Tyler of Aerosmith for Red. You know, it's okay to rock and roll and party down. Just don't get in that 2,000-pound bullet when you're done and cocked. And please don't drink and drive.
Someone that jaded you.
A reminder that friends don't let friends drive drunk. A public service message brought to you by the Ad Council, U.S. Department of Transportation, National Association of Broadcasters, and RAD.